This is Courage to Resist, bringing you the voices of the troops who refuse to fight. Steve Jozik joined the Coast Guard Reserve when he was 17 and later transferred to the Army. Almost immediately, he realized he had made a mistake when he heard gruesome stories from veterans returning from Iraq and saw how the military dehumanized and desensitized people. He became determined to find a way out, which led him ultimately to Canada. Steve is talking with us today from the IVAW house in Washington, D.C. Steve, thanks so much for talking with Courage to Resist today. Now, you began your military career in the Coast Guard Reserve, and then you made a switch to the regular Army. Is that right?
That's correct. At around June of 05, I basically got tired of my living situation and you know, just the day-to-day struggle, and I felt like I could contribute to something that was much better than, you know, making deli sandwiches, basically. And so I chose the Army because I had a vision in my mind that, you know, the Army was an institution that stressed, you know, thinking before shooting, kind of thing like that. I was, you know, further misled by my recruiter who signed me up for a communications job, which didn't exist anymore in the military. It was phased out actually in November of that year. From there, I went to a what's called the Warrior Transition Course, which is a prior service training course for prior service members. And it was basically 4 weeks of basic training, a compressed version of basic training. And so usually what normal recruits would spend a week or several days, you know, training for certain things, we spent one day. And interestingly enough, the longest amount of time that we spent training for anything was rifle. Just going to the range, we spent an entire week on that. I don't know, I started to have some real concerns about the decision that I had made when, while we were in training, there was a sergeant first class who he had been in combat before because he would tell us stories all the time of things that he had done and seen. And one thing in particular that sticks out in my mind is he was teaching us on tactical formations and basically how to apprehend and detain prisoners. And the one thing that he said towards the end of the lesson was, you know, all this training is good and well, but it's easier to just shoot a prisoner dead than to take him back to base and process him for paperwork because, you know, paperwork is such a big hassle. And so, I mean, and just the way that he had said it, you know, it was just deadpan, like it was just another business transaction, I guess you could call it.
Oh, so it was just part of the ordinary daily routine, eh?
Essentially, yeah, like, you know, just another inconvenience to deal with and move on with your job and continue getting paid. The disassociation that he had with it really impacted me at that point because I realized, you know, this person had been in the military for several years and he was so desensitized to, you know, reducing people to paperwork and, you know, dismissing them as such. And so from that point, I started to realize that I'd probably made a really big mistake, and I don't know, I figured that things might change because, you know, this is the training element, and once I got to school that things would probably be different, and then further on in the Army, you know, I'd hope things would be different. So I went on to Fort Gordon for the 20-week course for 25 Foxtrot, that's a network switching system operator maintainer. And halfway through that course is when I learned that the job that I was training for no longer existed in the Army. And this essentially meant that I would be either a driver or kicking in doors, whatever was really needed at the time in Iraq. On top of that, I was in a prior service company at Fort Gordon. So there were people there that had deployed several times, and they all had combat patches. And I spoke to several of them about, you know, once again, things that they had seen, stuff that they had experienced, and it was that really had an impact on me too. But what really got to me was, again, the desensitization that that these people exuded. They that most of them, if not all of them, were there just for the pay. They knew that they would be getting extra combat pay, hazardous duty pay, separation from family pay. That's you know, they went into really long detail about that, and I guess sort of the benefits, what they call the benefits of going to war, and no real discussion about, you know, the overall meaning of it or why we're there. Nobody really asked any questions. There's no real discussion about, you know, the situation that we were about to get into.
So how did you work over all of this in your own mind?
To be honest, I was starting to get pretty scared because, you know, I mean, to know that I was going to be in a combat situation, that was pretty scary. But what scared me even more was knowing that I was going to be surrounded by people that, you know, were so out of touch and their views were totally in not the right place, considering the situation that we were going to be in. And I realized I did not want to be putting my life into the hands of people like this and sort of depending on them to, I guess, sort of watch my back or, you know, whatever you want to call it. I mean, I don't have any combat experience, so I'm not really sure how to explain it, but that's when I started to realize that I should probably start working to get out.
So, you were troubled by what you thought you might have to do, and also by the mentality of the people around you, and you thought it might not be too safe depending on them in combat, is that right?
Exactly.
So you said you started to think about ways you could get out. Did you explore applying for conscientious objector status?
Well, that was brought up, and I was also suggested to me that I try to speak to the chaplain about that. Several times I tried to set appointments with the chaplain. He never responded. I was an E3 private first class, and I guess I wasn't really a high priority. I tried speaking to several enlisted members that were in the cadre, and they basically just would either tell me there was no point in it, or they would give me a long speech about why I should stay and how getting out would be bad because I'd just be right back where I started. And then there were several soldiers that had applied for conscientious objector status, and they were either sent on and were basically forced to sit on it while they were in theater, or it was just thrown out. So that was not an approachable avenue, so I went to other methods.
Now tell us about some of those other methods.
I was intentionally failing PT tests. At one point, I was able to get into the S4 office because I was cleaning it daily after I had finished school, and, you know, they were holding me. So I checked my file, and I knew at the time that the regulation was, you know, three failures, and then you go before either the first sergeant or the XO, and they review your motivation, and they, you know, basically check to see what the deal is. And that never, ever happened. And I know I failed well over three PT tests, and it must have been around 50, something like that.
Do you think that your chain of command was aware of your feelings and just decided to ignore those failures as a way of thwarting your efforts to get out?
It wasn't so much as an effort to thwart it. It was just that they were not allowed. They were under orders of some kind to just retain everybody at any cost unless they were a medical profile or, you know, a mental health or something like that.
So CO was out, failing PT test was out. What else did you try?
I tried gaining weight, I was just what people would call a shitbag. I would duck out of duty throughout the day. I would be gone the entire day. I would miss PT in the morning purposely. And, I mean, it was just counseling statement after counseling statement, and, you know, nothing else was being done. I eventually did get an Article 15, but that was just a slap on the wrist kind of thing. It wasn't really a big deal.
And how long did all of this go on?
This went on for about 7 months, 7.5 months after I completed school. And I eventually got to a certain point where I was extremely depressed. I felt like I was going insane because there was just, you know, there was no way out of this. And it was getting to the point where they were going to change the regulation for prior service members so that they would not be required to have a PT test in order to graduate AIT. So, and that was, you know, a couple of months off. And I knew that I was definitely going to be going to Iraq because everybody else that had graduated, that's exactly where they went. So I decided to take matters into my own hands, and I attempted suicide in August of 2006. And so when that didn't work, you know, I went through about a week and a half of counseling. They determined that I was still fit for duty. Simply because I got up out of bed and put on my uniform and showed up to formation. So that, to them, was fit for duty.
Oh, suicide. Steve, that's a shock. Well, I've got to tell you, I'm glad it didn't work. But you must have been really, really desperate to try to kill yourself.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I felt more comfortable taking my life in my own hands than to put it in the hands of these people that I had no trust in, and to make a sacrifice for a cause that I didn't feel was, you know, worthy of making a sacrifice for.
So now you've tried all these different things and nothing has worked. You're still in the Army. You're still headed to Iraq. What next?
Well, shortly after this, a friend of mine that I had met at Fort Gordon had come through from Germany. And at the time, he told me that he was going to his dad's funeral. But what he was actually doing was getting his car back, because I was holding on to it for him. And he drove up to Canada. And I spoke to him about a month later. He got in contact, and he told me the situation and why he was there, and, you know, how he had got up there. And there's the War Resister Support Campaign was supporting him and several other resistors that were up there. So I started doing research on that and realized that going to Canada was definitely an acceptable option. So on Thanksgiving of November 2006, I left Fort Gordon and ended up in Toronto and spent 2 years up there.
And did you hook up right away with the War Resister Support Campaign up there?
Yeah, I met up immediately the day that I arrived there with one of the lead campaign members there.
And they set you up with a living situation?
Yeah, they gave me temporary housing until I was able to get on my feet, and I was actually able to get a hold of a temporary work visa, so I was allowed to work legally in the country for a short while. And so basically I lived what I guess one would call an everyday, just an average, you know, 9-to-5 kind of life. But you know, we still had the whole deportation situation going on there, that, you know, Canada was trying to get rid of us, so wasn't exactly a comfortable living situation, but it was definitely a lot better than the alternative.
Well, it certainly was a sword hanging over your head, but it wasn't as big a sword as Iraq, I guess.
No, definitely not.
So you were there for 2 years. You lived, as you say, an ordinary life. And did the Army make any attempts to track you down?
No, actually. They sent two letters to my mother from the executive officer. The first was to notify her that I was AWOL and basically to encourage me to come back. The second one was to notify her that a warrant was issued for my arrest after being AWOL for 30 days, and that was it. I never heard from them. Nobody called me, nothing.
Now, while you were up there, did you involve yourself in any kind of anti-war work?
There were a few protests that I went to, but it was really difficult for me to wrap my head around, I guess, Canadian politics and the motivations therein. But there were a lot of rallies that they had for us, and I definitely went to those, and I spoke a couple of times and told my story.
Now, I want to go back a little bit, because you talked about having attempted suicide, and we know that's a desperate measure, and you had to be pretty troubled to take such an extreme step. Did all of that stop? Did your emotional state get better when you got to Canada? Did you feel that you were on the mend by then, or did you feel the need to address those emotional issues that led to your suicide attempt?
Well, I guess to put it shortly, when I arrived in Toronto, I was broken in half, and I was still very depressed and very antisocial for quite a while. And I did seek a little bit of help. But mainly, I was able to put myself back together on my own. I guess really what being in the Army really did was sort of prevent any sort of personal growth while I was there. And so actually being able to remove myself from that and then sort of having the time to lay low and I guess sort of just put my thoughts back together, that was really the best therapy that I had.
So you were able to pay attention to your own needs and not the Army's needs and to begin a process of healing.
Right.
And you were there for 2 years, and then what happened at the end of those 2 years?
Well, about a month and a half ago, I turned myself in at the border, and my reason for that was the Canadian Minister of Immigration had said in private that if we, the War Resisters, had applied for status in a less public way, which was to apply for refugee status, which, you know, against the United States, there's only about a 1% chance of success, and for soldiers, it's absolutely nil. And the reason why the War Resisters Support Campaign wanted that to happen is they wanted to sort of recreate the Trudeau days and publicly open the gates for soldiers who object to the war and want a way out. Really, the Minister of Immigration said that was just not possible these days, and it would have worked better if we had gone in a more subtle way as far as applying for status, and that it would have worked. But because we hadn't, they were just going to line up everybody one after the other, and eventually, one way or the other, they were going to deport people. And this has definitely been the case in the past year. Several people have been in line for deportation, and they were able to get extensions just based on technicalities, whether it was inconsistencies in the case being brought against them, or they had a child that had to finish the school year. And I know for me, for sure, I would have definitely been deported because I'd never been to war, and they would have been aware of the easy process for me to get a discharge, which I only became aware of about 5 months ago.
So let's talk about that easy process for getting a discharge. That must have come as a real surprise to you.
It was a huge shock, actually. Yeah, I didn't think that there was any chance at all for that. I thought I was going to be punished severely.
You figured you were going to go to prison.
Right, for 5 years or something like that.
So tell us what that process was.
Well, I call it easy because since I'd never graduated AIT and I'd been AWOL for more than 30 days, there's an Army regulation which states that anybody who falls into that category is under grounds for immediate discharge. So essentially all I had to do was turn myself in, not make any big scenes about it, not resist in any way, really. And so I was sent back to Fort Knox and discharged within a week.
And how did you become aware of this regulation?
I think I saw a post by James Branham, a link to his website and a pamphlet that he had typed up about a year prior, and it outlined the exact process and the sort of categories people fall into, whether they're OCONUS or anything like that. And I went to the section for AIT, and it was just like everything fit in line perfectly. So I contacted him. I spoke to him personally when he came up to Canada a few months ago, and he advised me that there wouldn't really be too much of a big problem. The only problem that might arise would be if my unit decided that they wanted to bring me back, to sort of reprimand me, which from Fort Gordon, he said that there's about a 2% chance of that happening. So
you turned yourself in at the border, and where did they take you from there?
Well, I turned myself in at the Peace Bridge and was detained at Erie County Jail for about 17 hours, and then MPs from Fort Drum apprehended me, took me, and brought me to Fort Drum. I spent the night there and then flew to Fort Knox to the personnel control facility, and a week later I was out.
Wow, this is a great story with a happy ending.
Yeah.
And you must be incredibly relieved.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't really feel too much of anything when I got out. I mean, I did feel a little bit of relief, but really it's just I'm so numb from all this. I don't really feel celebratory about it because there's still other people that, you know, don't have it as easy as me, and I don't know, I feel a sense of obligation to them.
So now today you're talking with us from the IVAW house in Washington, D.C., right?
That's correct.
So you've become a member of IVAW?
Yeah, I did while I was in Canada.
Now, Steve, as you reflect on your experiences with the military, from the Coast Guard at 17 until today, what are the lessons you've learned from all of this and lessons that might be helpful to other young people?
I'd say the number one lesson that I would have to share with someone is read. Read as much as you can. Absorb as much information as you can before you make any decision, no matter how big or small. That was my major downfall from the very beginning. You know, my father is pro-military. He served in Vietnam, and my head was full of stories that he told me. I went to high school ROTC and, you know, was pro-military as a kid, and I just didn't really pay much attention to anything else other than the aspects of being in the military. So that was the major problem for me.
So you would suggest to young people to really study what it is they're planning to do before they just go ahead and do it?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not a video game, it's not a movie, and it might seem like that until the very moment that you get there, and I guess to some people it still does, but, you know, what you take back from that, you can never return, you can never get rid of, and I know this just from listening to other veterans, and that would be another lesson I'd have to share with somebody is if you meet a veteran, and if you talk to him, listen to him, and take his stories to heart, take their stories to heart, and because that was another great source of, I guess, inspiration for me to continue resisting.
Now, you told us that your family was pro-military. How have they dealt with what you've done?
Well, my dad took a love-or-leave-it attitude with me on it, and he took a love-or-leave-it attitude about me leaving, and I guess in a sense he disowned me for a short while. And, you know, I tried to explain the reasonings to him, you know, the lies that were told and, you know, the pointlessness of it all. And he just, it was not getting through to him very well. And, I mean, we communicate a little bit now, but now that I'm back, he's definitely distant because he feels like I should have just stayed up there. You know, since I gave up my one chance to be a true American in his eyes, which, you know, is serving in the military.
Well, that's a story we hear a lot, sadly, about parents turning their backs on their children who resist. But you did something very brave. You didn't know you were going to get out so easily. You thought you might go to prison, and still you acted on your principles. I really admire your courage.
I appreciate that.
And I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.